Israel targets Hamas leaders inside Rafah.
Israel said that from a preliminary investigation, it appears that the airstrike sparked a fire in the area where a lot of displaced people had been sheltering. It's an area that Israel had designated as a safe zone.
Plus, thousands now fear dead following a landslide in Papua New Guinea.
I have 18 of my family members buried under the debris and soil that I'm standing on, and a lot more family members in the village I cannot count.
And later, at least 18 people are killed in Kharkiv. We'll get an update from Kyiv and a look at the coming presidential elections in Iran and South Africa. Today is Monday, May 27th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint, Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. We begin today in Pakistan, where heavily armed militants attacked a security outpost near the border with Afghanistan early on Monday, resulting in the deaths of five soldiers and seven assailants in the ensuing firefight. Militants allied with the outlawed Pakistani Taliban, or TTP, released a statement claiming responsibility for staging the raid in Tirah. The deadly attack came a day after the Pakistani military reported that a counter-terrorism raid near the provincial capital of Peshawar killed two Pakistani soldiers and five alleged terrorists, also believed to be linked to the TTP. Authorities in Papua New Guinea now say the death toll in last week's landslide in the country's north may reach into the thousands. Reuters' Gabe Singer has more.
More than 2,000 people could be buried alive by a massive landslide in Papua New Guinea last week. That's according to a new figure by the National Disaster Center on Sunday, which was released publicly by the United Nations on Monday. Evit Kambu says she lost 18 family members.
I have 18 of my family members buried under the debris and soil that I'm standing on, and a lot more family members in the village I cannot count. I am the landowner here. Thank you to all of those who have come to help us, but I cannot retrieve the bodies, so I'm standing here helplessly.
Estimates of those killed in the landslide around the Yambali village in the country's north have been rising steadily since Friday. Local media on Monday reported that residents had rescued a couple trapped under rubble after hearing their cries for help. But treacherous terrain in the remote location raises the risk that few further survivors will be found. A UN official said the first excavator did not reach the site till late on Sunday, more than 2 days after the landslide. And nearby tribal warfare, which killed at least 8 people on Saturday, has forced aid workers to lodge nearly 40 miles away, rather than staying closer to the site, which has further hampered relief efforts. More than 72 hours after the landslide, residents are still using spades, sticks, and their bare hands to try and shift the debris and reach any survivors. 6 bodies have been retrieved so far. CARE International estimates 4,000 people were living near the affected area, but the population is difficult to determine, as the country's last credible census was in 2000, and many people live in remote mountainous villages.
That's Gabe Singer of Reuters reporting for us today. And now we go to the Middle East. Israeli airstrikes have killed at least 45 Palestinians and wounded dozens in part of the southern Gaza Strip city of Rafah, designated for the displaced. That's according to the Palestinian Health and Civil Emergency Services on Sunday. Video taken that day showed people searching through rubble and carrying bodies into emergency vehicles.
We were sitting at the door of the house safely. Suddenly, we heard the sound of a missile. We ran and found the street covered in smoke. We did not see anything. We went into the house and did not find anyone until we checked over the wall and found a girl and a young man who had been cut to pieces.
The Israeli military said its air force struck a Hamas compound in Rafah and that the strike was carried out with precise ammunition on the basis of precise intelligence. It said it took out Hamas's chief of staff for the West Bank and another senior official behind the deadly attacks on Israelis. The strike hit the Tel al-Sultan neighborhood in western Rafah, setting parts of the area ablaze. Thousands of people were taking shelter there after fleeing the eastern areas of the city, where Israeli forces began a ground offensive over 2 weeks ago. Earlier on Sunday, the Israeli military said 8 projectiles were identified crossing from Rafah into Israel, prompting sirens to sound in the Israeli city of Tel Aviv for the first time in months. Video obtained by Reuters show the remains of a rocket outside a school in Israel. Israel has kept up operations in Rafah despite a ruling by the top UN court on Friday ordering it to stop attacking the city. Israel argues that the UN court's ruling allows for some military action there, and Israeli tanks have probed around the edges of the city but have not yet entered in force. For more detail and context on that attack in Rafah, I'm joined by VOA's Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Israel says that it was targeting 2 senior Hamas officials who had been active in supporting attacks against Israel in the West Bank. They were both killed. Israel said that from a preliminary investigation, it appears that the airstrike sparked a fire in the area where a lot of displaced people had been sheltering. It's an area that Israel had designated as a safe zone. And dozens of people were killed and dozens of others wounded. Several Arab countries and the Palestinian Authority accused Israel of intentionally targeting that area, which again, Israel had said was designated as a safe zone. Israel says it was acting within the boundaries of international law and that it will investigate. And the prosecutor general in the army, in a sort of an interesting statement, which is kind of rare, said that it was a very grave incident that must be investigated.
So if Israel says that they were going after specific individuals in Hamas, even says it killed them, and Arab neighbors and the Palestinians are saying it was a deliberate attack on civilians, is it safe to say that these Hamas individuals were among a civilian population?
Yeah, that apparently does appear to be the case. I mean, you know, all along Hamas has used civilians as human shields. And, you know, in Gaza, there are the tunnel entrances and exits go into private homes and there are guns in private homes. Apparently what happened is the Israeli attack on these 2 Hamas men, which Israel said was a pinpointed attack, sparked a fire which spread very quickly through these tents, and that most of the civilians who were killed, if not all of them, were killed by the fire and not necessarily by the Israeli attack.
And also, given that this attack came just days after the ruling from the International Court of Justice, is there an air of defiance by the Israeli authorities behind it, saying, we're going to continue doing what we do anyway?
Well, I'm not sure if it's defiance. I mean, I think that Israel was angry at the International Court of Justice ruling. Israel's angry as well by the recognition of Norway, Ireland, and Spain of a Palestinian state. I don't know that it was necessarily defiance. Israel says that all along its policy has been that when it has intelligence that Hamas members, senior Hamas members are in the vicinity, that they will attack them. That's been its policy since October 7th, and that really hasn't changed. But I think there is kind of an attitude in Israel that the international community just doesn't understand what's going on here, that the international community is playing down what happened on October 7th, the rape and the murder of 1,200 Israeli civilians. So, you know, the sense, what they're saying is, you know, we're going to do what we have to do independent of any international court or international opinion.
It's VOA's Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem. Linda, thanks for your reporting.
Thank you, Steve.
You're listening to Flashpoint Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. A trilateral summit with China, Japan, and South Korea. We'll find out what happened in a moment. First, though, a Russian missile attack over the weekend at a popular shopping mall filled with people in Ukraine's second-largest city of Kharkiv leaves at least 18 dead and a dozen wounded. Lori London gets an update from Anna Chernikova in Kyiv.
So it was yet another difficult weekend for Ukraine, especially for the city of Kharkiv in the eastern part of the country. The city of Kharkiv is under really heavy shelling for the past months. And on Saturday, it was yet another really heavy attack Russian forces hit one of the shopping malls, a really popular chain within the Ukrainians, with two missiles. This shopping mall chain usually over the weekend collect a lot of people who come just to buy different kind of stuff. And on Saturday, it was also another busy day. At this point, just recently confirmed that at least 18 people were found dead as a result of this attack, and dozens are injured. Still, it's not clear the final numbers, because the rescue operation, the operation to find bodies of people, is still ongoing, and debris on the side of this shopping mall is really difficult to search because of the heavy fire that was on the site. But at this point, the emergency service of Ukraine confirms that at least 45 people were injured as a result of the attack and 18 killed.
Was the whole mall completely destroyed?
Almost. The most part of the mall was destroyed. Everything was on fire. The footage, which is available from the security cameras, show that there were two hits. Two missiles hit directly the shopping mall. And as I already mentioned, it's a very popular chain of the shopping mall within Ukraine. So across Ukraine, you can find this particular chain, and it is really popular with Ukrainians, and especially over the weekend, a lot of people come to purchase different kind of stuff.
And what's the latest on the front line, Anna? In the past few weeks, it's been pretty intense.
The most active actions on the front line are happening in the Kharkiv region and in the Donetsk regions. It is quite clear that Russian forces are trying to create a so-called gray zone or buffer zone on the territory of Ukraine, close to the border, in order to just to have a certain area where Russian forces can allocate for further actions, active actions, as experts believe. At this point, what intelligence of various countries are telling, and what Ukrainian intelligence also confirmed, Russian forces did not manage to create this buffer zone along the whole territory of Kharkiv region. But President Zelensky said that it will be expected that a new assault will be happening.
President Volodymyr Zelensky arrived in Madrid, Spain on Monday, meeting with the prime minister, looking to continue to get support to help Ukraine fight. What can you tell us about the visit?
First of all, I would like to mention that this trip was postponed by President Zelensky. He was supposed to visit Madrid a bit earlier, but due to the Russian assault in the Kharkiv region, he postponed the trip. And on Monday, he arrived to Madrid, to Spain. He was met personally by the King of Spain, and later he met with the head of the Spanish government to sign a military agreement, a military support agreement with Spain. This agreement is one of those that Ukraine is signing with different countries as a long-term support of Ukraine, mostly in the military, sector, in the military and defense areas. And what we know about particularly this agreement with Spain, that it was signed for 1 billion euros of military aid in a period up to 2027, and also 5 billion euros Spain will be providing to Ukraine through the European Peace Fund. So 1 billion direct aid and 5 additional billion aid will be also allocated through the Peace Fund.
Lori London is the host of Flashpoint Ukraine here on VOA. She was speaking with correspondent Anna Chernikova in Kyiv. And now, leaders from China, Japan, and South Korea met for their first three-way talks in 4 years on Monday in Seoul. South Korean officials said President Yoon Suk-yeol, Chinese Premier Li Qiang, and Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida will adopt a joint statement on 6 key areas, including economy, trade, science, technology, and people-to-people exchanges. Li hailed the talks as a restart and a new beginning. The rare summit comes amid global tensions that have strained trade and security dialogues among East Asia's economic powerhouses. China, U.S.-allied South Korea, and Japan are trying to manage rising distrust amid the rivalry between Beijing and Washington and tensions over democratically ruled Taiwan, which China claims as its own. Yoon and Kishida have charted a closer course with each other and to Washington, embarking on unprecedented cooperation with the United States. Yoon also asked China to play a constructive role with its partners in North Korea, which is expanding its nuclear weapons and missile arsenal in defiance of UN Security Council resolutions. In fact, North Korea fired an unidentified projectile on Monday, hours after Pyongyang said it would be launching a satellite sometime before June 4th. This prompted Japanese authorities to issue an emergency alert for Okinawa. Following the death of Iran's president, Ibrahim Raisi, in a helicopter crash just over a week ago, political forces inside Iran are beginning to prepare for a sooner-than-expected presidential contest. For more, my colleague Michael Lippin spoke with Jason Brodsky. He's policy director of United Against Nuclear Iran.
I would say that the new parliament is mostly an indicator of the constellation of power and the trend lines there with respect to the Islamic Republic. It is not an indicator as to the substantive policymaking that the Islamic Republic's leadership will employ. The parliament's a rubber stamp on many of the core issues of concern that ail the relationship between the United States and Iran, like the nuclear file and the regional malign behavior and human rights abuses as well. So I would look at the new parliament in that sense. Where it does also matter is that this week there will be a new speaker of parliament who will be announced and elected by its new members. And that is an important post, not because the person has any kind of singular authority over any of those issues, but the Speaker of Parliament has a seat on the Supreme National Security Council of Iran, which is in charge with debating and forming consensus over the most important and sensitive files of the Islamic Republic.
Well, of course, Iran's supreme leader Khamenei is the ultimate authority in the country, and it was clear that Raisi was his preferred pick for president the last time around. What signals should we be looking for regarding who the supreme leader wants to be the next president?
Well, I think we have to be looking at the Guardian Council and who they disqualify in this round of presidential elections. As I said before, there are a few candidates who were being spoken about in Iranian media. I'll list them briefly. Saeed Jalili, who is a very, very hardline figure who was formerly the secretary of the Supreme National Security Council, and he is the supreme leader's representative on the Supreme National Security Council currently. And he has been in favor of very aggressive moves on advancing Iran's nuclear program. So there is Saeed Jalili, who has announced his candidacy. Then we have other figures like Ali Larijani, who seems to have a personal desire to run, but he is unsure of the Nizam or the system's green light for his candidacy. And that is because of the baggage that he has from the 2021 presidential race when he was disqualified in a very embarrassing manner after serving as the Speaker of Parliament in Iran. Then there are also figures like Mehrdad Bazarpash, who's the Rhodes Minister, who's a former alumni of the Ahmadinejad administration, was a member of the Student Basij organization. And then there is Parviz Fatah, who is the head of the execution of Imam Khomeini's order. Fatah is an IRGC member who has been the head over several state foundations and enterprises linked to the economy. Then we also have other figures on the field as well. And so we can keep going on, but those are the ones I would outline.
What do you think the Supreme Leader Khamenei is looking for in his next president? Because as we know, he will have a great influence over who runs and who ultimately becomes the next president.
I think Ayatollah Khamenei is laser focused on succession in the Islamic Republic. That is his largest priority. And he wants to put and install someone in the presidency who is a trusted pair of hands during a very sensitive moment in the Islamic Republic's history. And let's not forget that the next president will be in office for 4 years, for the full 4-year term. So this is a long-term placement in this office. And he is interested in making sure that that office is occupied by someone who will not cause problems for Khamenei's priorities during succession.
That was VOA's Michael Lippin in conversation with Jason Brodsky of United Against Nuclear Iran. And in other election news, the African National Congress has been governing South Africa since 1994, when Nelson Mandela was elected president following the end of apartheid. But as voters get ready to go to the polls on May 29th, the party known for its opposition to apartheid faces dissatisfaction from some citizens who feel it has not delivered on its promises. VOA's Mariama Diallo has the story.
On the streets of Johannesburg, posters of candidates are displayed all over the city. One voter tells VOA he wants continuation and will cast his ballot for the African National Congress. Another one says he's had enough and will vote for the Democratic Alliance.
30 years of democracy is probably 30 years of policy. We need another 30 years of implementing those policies and seeing them coming through to fruition.
Because they're all about change. Enough is enough. We've had enough of the empty promises.
Housing, water.
In a promo video, ANC leader Cyril Ramaphosa says they've made progress in meeting the basic needs of the people of South Africa.
We are putting South Africa to work by investing in our people, to ensure that no one is left behind.
Daryl Glazer, associate professor at the University of Witwatersrand in Johannesburg, says it's going to be the closest election since the era of inclusive democracy began in South Africa in 1994.
All the opinion polls are suggesting that there's a very serious chance that the ANC is going to fall below 50% of the vote and that it's going to be forced into some kind of coalition.
Glazer and other analysts have told VOA that allegations of corruption, scandals, and disunity within the ANC have helped the opposition gain ground, including the Economic Freedom Fighters Party led by Julius Malema, a former ANC youth leader, and the newly formed Umkhonto Wesizwe Party, which former President Jacob Zuma has been campaigning for. 9 days before the election, South Africa's top court ruled that Zuma was not eligible to run for parliament because of a past criminal conviction. The ruling came 2 days after Zuma told thousands of supporters at the rally in Soweto that his MK party would help ease joblessness, among other issues, if it won. South Africa's unemployment rate has reached 32%, according to the World Bank, making it issue number one for many of the voters.
I think our biggest challenge as a country is our rate of unemployment, which is one of the biggest in the world.
I'll be voting for Action SA, and I think that party has got our what we have, what we want in the country. Like now, we got a problem with the crime, and there's no work.
For me, it'll be poverty and unemployment. The lack of maintenance of infrastructure is another pressing issue.
Nearly half of the country's 62 million people have registered to vote, says Thabo Masemola, an independent electoral commission official, and he says they are prepared to manage the vote efficiently, as they've done historically.
The certified voters' roll is currently sitting as 27.7 million. And we use the voters' roll as the basis to prepare and plan for elections. So all the relevant election material are in place.
He says the IEC has accredited 160 organizations, both domestic and international, to observe the election and ensure its transparency. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
And that's going to wrap it up for us today. There is more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with the 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.